100.3 K-Talk Podcast. The Darkness Radio with Dave Schrader. Weeknights from 9 to midnight on 100.3 K-Talk.
Good evening. Welcome back. This is your Wednesday night edition of Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio. Thank you for joining us and finding us right here on your FM dial Monday through Friday, 11 p.m. till midnight. Joining me this evening, Mally Fox. Good evening, Mally.
Good evening.
Wow, last night's show went by quick.
I know.
It's intriguing content. We've been having great shows this last couple of weeks. I'm really thankful for all the fantastic guest suggestions we've had pointed out to us. I'm your host on the show, Dave Schrader. And this evening, we're going to follow up with the interview we began last night. And we have joining us Nigel Kerner. We also have Andrew Silverman and John Biggerstaff. And we're talking about the ideas and beliefs that are in the brand new book that has been published by Nigel, which is entitled, oh, good grief, my mind just went blank here, The Gray, Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, which is an intriguing topic to me. We covered a lot of different items last night, and tonight we're going to try to tie them all together. And let's reintroduce our guest this evening, Nigel Kerner. Good evening, sir. Thank you for coming back.
Good evening, David.
I appreciate it. Again, I know it's late for you, and I appreciate you bringing these guys back in with us. And
no problem whatsoever. No problem. It's a privilege to be with you.
Andrew Silverman is also joining us. Good evening, Andrew.
Hi. Good evening.
Thank you very much. And also joining us, John Biggerstaff. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Dave.
Well, it's a little easier for you, not quite as late here in the United States as it is for our other two guests. But thank you for joining us as well. We started scratching the surface last night, spent an hour that flew by in a blink of an eye with all the information you were able to share with us. I just to kind of recap on this now, give us a bit of information about the new book that's out, and then we can go back in with Andrew and start talking a little bit about where we left off last night.
It's quite simply an excursion into all the various probabilities and possibilities that are unfolding with this phenomenon we call the UFO phenomenon, and how the whole thing might tie in with the existential platform of our own psychologies as human beings, and how this then goes into philosophy and so forth, because there seemed, in my research, it seemed from a disparate subject we might just quantify and qualify as UFOs. It, as you connected up the dots and the more research was done and looked at in as objective a stance as I could possibly manage it, I began to discover that this led into all the various departments that make us what we are. And, of course, there comes out of it something extremely intriguing and interesting, and in some instances rather menacing, and in some instances absolutely wonderful. So putting all this together has been a great adventure for me. It's taken me three books to do. I don't know if we'll be able to do anything near the full story in the time we'll be talking on the radio here, but we'll do our best to try to give you a kind of précis of it all. And as part of that, I was trying to bring in Andrew Silverman, who's a medical doctor who's an expert on this Shroud of Turin phenomenon in the philosophical sense, and he made a very important dissertation speech at the recent Frascati Symposium of Scientists in Italy that are looking at the latest research mechanisms that account for this phenomenon they call the Shroud of Turin, where an image of a man is in death is printed on a shroud, a cloth that covered his dead body. And by all intimations, it seemed it may well fit the cloth that covered Jesus Christ, the Christian prophet. And so Dr. Silverman has some rather interesting insights into the philosophy behind all of this and how it might connect up with an artificial type of being, which I believe these so-called grays of the UFO phenomenon are, and how they interface with our humanity through the property of someone who, from our own humanity, did something as remarkable as perhaps what they call the resurrection.
Okay. What I was trying to describe about the shroud is how amazingly unique this object is, to have this image on it, which cannot be reproduced even with 21st century science, can't match anything like it or even close. Now, of course, as the imprint of a dead man on the cloth, that the dead man was shining brighter than the sun. Of course, that raises questions about death and life and so on. And there's been a lot of very good scientific research that's been done, for example, on near-death experiences, for example, which has shown that even when the brain waves are flat, that the human mind is capable of experiencing things, perceiving things that the physical senses wouldn't possibly have been able to take in, to be able to see things remotely and so on. And there are several eminent biologists and neuropsychiatrists who have been studying this in great detail. And one in particular, recognized scientist in the UK and psychiatrist by the name of Peter Fenwick, has said that he's really had to completely rethink the idea, the definition of what the mind is, that it can't just be made by the brain. It can't be a product of the brain if when the brain stops, the mind continues. Now, the image of the shroud has actually been shown to, when it's been studied by the forensic pathologists, that at the time that the imprint was made, the body of the man was actually upright and probably suspended in the air, wasn't actually even on the ground. And at that moment, his body shone brighter than the sun. So there was a dead body there, presumably on the slab, which rose up and then Sean. Now, I was introducing yesterday evening about Nigel's hypothesis that actually the thought, light, and matter are actually part of a continuum, that actually that matter is in many ways could be seen as frozen light. And that light is in many ways akin to an expression of what thought has become in separation. And I was introducing the idea that actually quantum theory suggests that as sentient beings with minds that we have no beginning, and therefore we were once all one as the universe was all one, and that perhaps in separating we have the physical universe has happened out of that. And now, once that separation happens, it makes a momentum that science calls entropy, or the second law of thermodynamics, that breaks everything apart. Once we take on restriction and limit, then the tendency is that begets more limit and more restriction. So we become more ignorant, which means we don't see the value of other human beings. So then we fight wars, and then we end up with atom bombs or greenhouse effects or whatever it is that in the end wipes out species from the planet. So that actually that our degradation happens as a vicious circle, if you like, out of that. And there have been in history certain people who've actually bore witness to an opposite way of going about things that actually unites rather than dividing, this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself, as Jesus taught. And that perhaps if you do that, if it was our separation and our restriction and our division that actually made physicality happen, made us become trapped in atoms, perhaps, and that matter is just trapped thoughts, then perhaps in undoing that restriction, we actually undo the bounds that hold matter separate, and actually it then begins to shine. And it's interesting that there are many depictions in historical art of people with light around them who are considered to be great teachers or holy people or whatever, that actually maybe there's an actual physical process going on here. Now, to tie this into Nigel's ideas about greys and so on, there's one particular quote that is often quoted from the Bible, which is very interesting. And the one where Jesus was supposed to have been tempted by what was described as a devil, and it's interesting to speculate about what the devil is. Of course, if you look at the mythological aspects of this creature that's known as Satan, it's often referred to as something that fell from out of the sky. Now, in the temptation, Jesus was taken to a high point where he could see all the cities of the earth. And as Nigel points out, the only place you can see all the cities of the earth from is in space. if you face one particular way, view of the Earth, you can do it. Have an experiment with a globe and face it one way, and all the landmass can be all facing you, and you'd have the sea on the other side. You can be out in space and have all the cities in the Earth beneath you, but you can't do it from the top of a building. So this is equating, according to the biblical account, that Jesus was tempted by some kind of space creature who is referred to as the devil. Now, the devil need not, if it's going to be opposite to God, it's not as opposite as you can get, because perhaps you can't have a true opposite to God. But it's not going to be have anything of God in it. It's not going to be, it's not, if God is that, if that state of being altogether in perfect union that I referred to with no limit, and it's having an aspect of that in us that makes us aware, makes us be able to choose. Well, something that's opposite to him won't have that. It would just be mechanical. So it does fit with his hypothesis that actually that's what these creatures are, that they're not truly living. And in their sense of describing them as artificial intelligence, it's only intelligence in the sense that a machine or a computer has intelligence, not in the sense, the warm, enlivened sense that a human being has intelligence in terms of being able to be aware and of themselves and others, and to actually have empathy and recognize the value of humanity.
Yeah, and may I just come in here, David?
Please.
For a moment, and the intriguing thing here was, what is this hallmark disparity between this being that they call Jesus Christ and this individual that seems to have ownership of the planet? He said, I will give you all these things if you jump down or if you worship me or whatever. Obviously something was in charge of this planet to do that to a Jesus Christ or whatever. Now, from what I can tell, in terms of the evidence, the physical evidence that I have looked at and the anecdotal evidence that I've looked at in this UFO phenomenon business, it seems these things have been here for 200,000 years, probably manipulating our species into what it is for a purpose. Now, what could that purpose be? Maybe the very fact that they picked up some living humanoid, Homo erectus or whatever it is, genetically altered that, was the fact that they could see that we were capable naturally, as natural living life, of birth and stuff like that, reproducing themselves. If, as Andrew says, the second law of thermodynamics takes care of everything, undoes absolutely everything, everything rots. We rot from the moment we're conceived. Your beautiful sports car, I'm sure you've got a beautiful sports car, would fall into rust, you know, whatever it is, if you didn't bring thought into it and look after it from the human point of view and so on. If we didn't have that kind of propensity, we couldn't cancel out anything, and that comes from will, comes from a capacity that a machine will not have. And maybe being artificially intelligent to such an extent, they could see that we had something that they could never have, fascinated them so much, they do want to append themselves in some kind of way into us. And that means matching, perhaps, our own physical reality, our DNA, the things that make us naturally what we are physically, into their disposition of being. And this is where Professor Biggestock comes in with his interpretation in biochemical science and so forth of how this particular thing might be built up step by step. And so I think that might be a point in which and John Biggestock might come in with his contribution to this. And if you see what I'm trying to say, I'm trying to actually get together and marry up all these various factors.
And you're doing a great job.
Into a hole, you know?
Certainly. Mr. Biggestock, feel free to join in on this now.
Yeah. Well, Nigel and Andrew have both alluded to the fact that these greys are of a sort of roboid descent with an artificial intelligence, which is very different to the intelligence which Andrew alluded to is where we naturally come from. Now, one of the big problems is that this artificial intelligence is incapable, really, because it's effectively made of an atomic design, really only knows how to manipulate atomic processes and the forces associated with them, such as electromagnetics, etc. And so when they find a planet such as this with beings which can reproduce and then come back again, and we haven't got into the reincarnation, but we may have time in a little while, that beings can actually sort of return And they can actually measure these signals as human beings actually transit through life and death, etc. Now, their problem is, well, they've got no way of understanding it, because these spaces between the atoms that Nigel alludes to in his book are not accessible by atomic processes. Now, one of the big problems in our own society to do with this is that we seem to be moving headlong, really to try and make the equivalent of what the greys are. And it may be that the greys are really the final endpoint of what it is our technology. As soon as we get technology in our society, we seem to go on this sort of trip to try and create these artificial things. And there is a huge amount of work actually being done on this at the moment to generate artificial computers, etc. Nigel's actually written a couple of articles on this. But this AI is becoming more and more prevalent. And, you know, people are now talking about, with our advances in computers, of actually putting biochips inside ourselves. There's a lot of research has actually been done on the interface between biological cells and electronics, for instance, so that electronics and cells can actually interact together. In addition to that, we've gone a long, long way towards actually inserting nanotechnology into ourselves. And, you know, I actually do some of the biological testing for nanoparticles, et cetera, to see whether or not they're actually toxic. So I sort of come in contact with some of the scientists working on these things. And really, because of this lack of, there's been a real problem in biological science over the years, in that really, in the early 20th century, really the drive was to understand how the molecules of biology and human beings actually worked. And there's been quite a bit of success in, for instance, medical science and the ability to heal and cure certain diseases. But really, we're not actually getting at the prime cause of all of this. And so with what Andrew alluded to earlier, once physics started to come up with the idea that the consciousness is actually capable of changing this atomic framework, then really we beg the question in biology, well, what is consciousness then? And then we find, and in fact it's generally accepted at the moment, that we really don't have sufficient scientific method to be able to even address such questions as scientists. And so a growing number of scientists, and I'd like to include myself among them, are really trying to find ways in which we can objectively as possible study this very subjective subject of the individual and the consciousness behind it. And therefore, really, we're in a huge amount of, because of this, we're in a huge amount of danger from these alien entities, if you like, but if they are in fact machines. Because in fact, then we just become an experiment within that process. Mm-hmm. And what they can do is, and, you know, as Nigel alluded to, one of the thing that they're really after is this ability of ours, which seems to be beyond their capability, this ability to actually resist the pull of the entropy or this decay process in the universe, at least for a short time. And so what they want to do is effectively piggyback on the back of this. And so they obviously they look at our genetics and they try and manipulate the genetics of us so that they become more compatible with us as we become more compatible with them.
If I just come in, John, the interesting thing here, you see, David, is that we're reaching this interface where we can jump from a machine to a natural living being into this incredible manifestation of what natural living beings are capable of in the hands of a great exponent, the greatest exponent of natural living being, which was this prophet, this Christian prophet, Jesus Christ, as he manifested it at the resurrection. That was the culmination to say, listen, if you're natural and you do these things with your mind in such a way and that you can use the mind to bring things together, you will in fact undo the physicality of your being and then present yourself into an eternal scale of existence. That's the only thing he ever promised. It seems to me, if you read the Bible and you look through it, there's only one thing this particular individual promised, and that was eternal life. Quite a fascinating
fascinating thing. With all he did, that was the only thing he really promised us, the scale of eternal existence. And, of course, the big, big demon in all of this is the second law of thermodynamics, which is the law of physics, which prevails all over the universe and the atomic universe, the universe of force, shall we say. And I think that there, he was alluding to another universe. If there's a universe of force, there has to be the opposite. There's a yin, there's a yang, the plus, there's a minus. When we've got an electron, we've got its opposite, and so on. And so, therefore, by illusion, by incidental alluding to it, I think he was establishing that there is such a thing that might, for want of a better word, be called the Godverse, where everything goes the other way, comes together, and stays forever on an eternal basis, whereas our universe, our entire universe, is in the process of breaking into parts and fractionating, and any cosmologist today will tell you that the end product of all of this is nil. There's going to be nothing left. Even subatomic particles will be unraveled, and we have a cold, forced, absolute forced paradigm which is going to be left. Now, that is therefore a finite state. It ends. And that's the problem. So in tying all this, you can see what a difficult juxtaposition of all these balls in the air, so to speak. You've got to tie all these various fractions together and come at a coherent theory, a thesis. And that's why it's taken me three books to do this. The second book gets about three quarters of the way. The third one is now completed. But I really want to see what the rest of the world thinks. I'm not here to preach new meanings to anyone, David. I really don't know enough to do that. But I'd like people to take a look outside the box, so to speak, from time to time, and just take a look at all of this and see, maybe we might discover that this phenomenon of grays is going on all over the universe. We're sending robots now all around the universe looking for various places and whatever it is, so that we can export our rubbish out there. I think that's a terrible premise, really, to be honest, to go out there taking all of us, and we can't learn to live and look after our own planet, so we go out there and pollute another one we might find. I mean, that's an absolutely crazy situation, as far as I'm concerned. So the point is, we really got to try to make ourselves understood, firstly, in our own terms, how wonderfully special we are, if we can and are capable of eternal life, as this great prophet came to warn us about. I think he actually came here to warn us about the phenomenon of artificial roboidic life in our universe. And we're now discovering so many planets like our Earth. Well, I'll tell you what, mate, it's odds on that these guys are prevailing everywhere. And if you get some of these guys on your planet, you are in big trouble. And the people who are hiding their existence here are the biggest, for me, the biggest criminals of all. And that's something that really we ought to try to get exposed, you know, that all these wonderful people are being rubbished as liars and cheats and whatever, when in fact they're doing their best to bring this to the attention of every living human being with a capacity, as Jesus showed us, to perhaps be able to transfigure ourselves or to have some, do something as he did, because he did say we'd all be able to do this. And I'm really not pushing the Christian line. I really do not believe in any kind of religious ethos as such, but I do believe in sense. I hope that that's something that I can appeal to everyone to do. And thank you very much for your indulgence in not coming through and interrupting this perhaps mighty boring monologue, you know.
Not at all. It's intriguing to hear, and to hear from different points. We have to take a quick break. We've got two more segments left with our guests, so stay tuned. We've got more Darkness Radio coming up with Nigel Kerner, John Biggerstaff, and with Andrew Silverman. From Ali Fox, this is Dave Schrader. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio, Darkness Radio on 100.3 K-Talk. Good evening. Welcome back to the show. Darkness Radio is on the air Monday through Friday, 11 p.m. till midnight. Come along as we explore UFOs, aliens, ghosts, Bigfoot, psychic phenomena, the Bermuda Triangle, and beyond. Mally Fox, my co-host. I'm Dave Schrader. So, Mal, is your eyes swimming with your mind right now?
Oh, my gosh. I'm still hung up on that idea of human harvesting. It's very unnerving.
Very unnerving.
Yes.
Right. And we're talking to our guest, Nigel Kerner. The two books out, Song of the Greys and Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, is the new book that's out. Nigel, let me ask real quickly here. So you believe that aliens are using us, they're manipulating us, to what end?
I think in their own terms, they're looking for the factors that define our own existence. The fact that we might have this propensity to die and live again. NDEs are proving
for me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that there is a life beyond the atom, and that this wonderful thing can be, that unfortunately, that unless we do the thing properly, as the great teachers told us, we keep going and returning, coming back. And, you know, that takes in this mechanism they call reincarnation in Eastern religions. But I'll tell you what, mate, there, every single religion once upon a time believed in it till the old guys threw it out because they wanted us to have one chance. And one chance means greater control. So the problem is, you know, the truth may well be that we have just a simple propensity to change our minds, and maybe we can move forward into something wonderful. I just wanted to actually take you on something that I recall that said in James, for instance. And it says there in James, if you look at some of the research I did was in this, on the Coptic Gnostic Gospels. A lot of the interesting stuff, by the way, is in these books of the Christian Codex actually throughout. And in this, it says here, there are numerous accounts within many texts of the Gnostic library in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced with them. Most notable of these explanations is that given in the first apocalypse of James in the Nag Hammadi Codex. If anyone can look at that,
right,
you'll find a very interesting exposition. And in this text, Jesus explains to the apostle James how to cope with the archons. Now, the archons are a reference commonly accepted to be some kind of alien being. And that if you're faced with an archon and with their representatives, as in fact Jesus was in the desert in Judea, as Andrew explained to you, then there are certain expressions of behavior you have to say. For instance, he dealt with them by saying, "Get thee behind me, Satan. It is written that thou art less than an insect," kind of thing, you know. And so, being a machine, of course, because you don't have a natural derivational continuity, as incidentally, my expression or understanding of a soul is very simple. It is that line that connects you and me from wherever that our derivational line comes from, through our granddad, our great-granddads and grandmas and whatever, ancestral line. And each one of us has a specific line leading to us here in contemporary times. And all the knowledge that has been gathered within that line is juxtaposed somewhere within each of us. And to me, a soul is simply that natural derivational line that comes from the beginning of the universe. And remember, the difference between a gray or a machine-type psychology is that they begin with us. We make them right in this universe. They don't come in with it like we do. And so we have a fantastic capacity and propensity, because we're natural living beings, for doing wondrous things. And I think we've forgotten, David. And that's mainly what it is. I've been looking for what we've forgotten, if you like it, in a nutshell. So maybe Andrew would like to take that on a bit.
Yes, certainly. As I was saying before, the fundamental difference between any human being, whatever their race, religion, nationality, beliefs, and so on, that has their uniqueness against every other object that we know about in this universe. Well, there may be some other planets out there, perhaps, that might have equivalents to human beings, but that we have this capacity for freedom of choice. Now, if we have freedom of choice, what that means is that we're actually making something happen that isn't made to happen by anything else. Usually in the physical world, things happen according to forces. You know, the billiard ball idea, that one hits another one, which hits another one, and it all connects up. But yet, actually, if such a thing as free will exists, then there's the capacity to determine something beyond all of that, without being determined by any of that. Now, if Nigel is right that matter is just a derivation out of mind, out of thought, if you like, and that's actually what the quantum physics actually does point towards that being the case, then it would fit that perhaps if you want to understand where does free will come from, where does this capacity to make choices freely come from, well, what does it mean to make a choice? What it means is that we're doing something that we're not, or choosing to do something that we're not forced to do, whereas matter follows forces that force it to do it. And quite simplistically, that's the way it is. Now, why does this is a great mystery to many scientists. Why does matter obey these physical laws? They have these mathematical equations, and then matter comes and follows it. Or more to the point, if free will exists also, why does matter obey us? Why does, if you decide that you want to raise your arm, how did then that decision, which is an abstract ethereal thing, actually affect the brain to make changes happen, to make that arise? Now, if it is all a continuum, then perhaps will is what happens where there is no force. This idea, if you like, I like this, that quote about peace on earth and goodwill to all men. This idea that actually where you have no force, that's where freedom happens. And as you become more restricted, you become more enforced, you become more separate, you become more divided because you become more selfish, you become more self-centered, you become less empathic, and you become more like a physical being. Once you're purely like a physical being, there's no difference between you and an animal. And this, even an animal still has something that the grey doesn't have, in the sense that there still is some kind of scope of awareness, but in such a restricted form. So this is the idea that actually, as Nigel says, a grey is even less than an insect, because even anything that's living has its, can trace its line back to right to the beginning. And a grey is what he calls a artificial secondary creation, that it's made by something living, but it isn't. It doesn't have that ability to connect itself
right, so,
back.
So who is studying us then? Is it that which created the grey that's studying us, or is it the grey has taken on its own interest in what we are, and they're studying us?
Good question. We think that perhaps these things have been done by a previous civilization of a huge size and magnitude that actually created things to look after the utilities within their own frame of existence. And these things were programmed with a paradox, unfortunately, which said, number one, look after yourself so you can look after us. That means look after any dangers that might threaten you so you can be there to look after us. If that's the case, then they would go out into the universe to make sure that there are no dangers to their primary creators who program in the first place with this particular line. Now, the point is that the only people who could actually take out the greys, if they were robots and program them, would be the ones that created them, which means that the greys would pull the plug out on their own creators. And then that would leave them with a program to fulfill. And then that would be taken out into space or everywhere, and they come across perhaps our own planet with their ability to go past the speed of light, which in fact is now beginning to be a plausible thing, a really plausible thing, as science discovers more and more, as cosmology will tell you as we go on. And I think this is a commonplace thing, David, in the universe, particularly in our galaxy, that these things are out there. And the great lesson is, do not make artificial beings. Do not make things that would actually be able to not understand the framework of the principles of some sense of feeling towards something else. If you have a program in your own aegis and you don't understand who you are or what you are as self, you've got a big problem. And so the great lesson for us is, do not create machines with artificial intelligence. That would be the greatest disaster that could befall us. And I think that these things are here prompting that to happen on Earth. And I think all of us should look at this very carefully. And if there is some special cartel in this planet, I really don't know, but perhaps there is, from all the signs, that they are looking to do this for some reason. Maybe they have been taken over. Maybe these things can hybridize are human beings now, as some people claim, and so on. I think that there are some eminent researchers that actually have this postulation. I don't doubt this, you know, it's a possibility, and that these people are going to be extremely powerful, and that you and I might be the Johnny-come-latelys, so to speak, out there, that they could come and affect and so on, our families and whatever. And I think we somehow, for our children's sake, have to be able to get out there and expose this and see what we're dealing with if these things are already here. So if you say to me now, look, Nigel, what kind of thing would you say to people in terms of reacting to this
particular phenomenon.
Well, we're going to ask you that, but we're going to have to ask you that when we come back from our next break. Okay. We're taking another break. Our guests are with us, Nigel Kerner, Andrew Silverman, and John Biggerstaff. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio, Monday through Friday, 11 p.m. till midnight. You can find Mally and I here as we investigate monsters, myths, and legends on 100.3 K-Talk. Welcome back to the show. Wrapping up another night here on Darkness Radio. Tonight, I want to get right back into it because we've only got about 10 minutes left with our guests, Nigel Kerner, John Biggerstaff, and Andrew Silverman. And we're talking about the new book that Nigel has out, which is called Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, which is the second part of a trilogy. His first book, The Song of the Grays, is out. Get Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls available right now. Before I went to the break, Nigel, you were bringing up what you believe is the big question. Please.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm often asked the question, David, if you could give one salient piece of advice to all human beings about how to resist an alien interception, what would it be? First, let me claim that I really don't know this for sure, but it seems to me from my own researches and as a summary of all the things I understand about the phenomenon as a result of it, and only in that context, I would say, for instance, if you are an abductee, I don't think you should despair at all. These people go through absolute hell and real hell. This is a genuine phenomenon, and some wonderful research has been done by Professor Jacobs and Bud Hopkins on this, and these are just wonderful people who have done a great service for mankind, and I absolutely believe that their veracity and integrity is unimpeachable. I have to say that here for the record. I say that if you are an abductee, it may just be, you know, that abductees are amongst those whom the Greys have problems introducing their programs into. I believe that these things are constantly doing this. In a hidden aegis protected by humanity or some types of humanity, they are trying to do this. And I think abductees are abducted because they can't. There's some propensity within an abductee that they can't actually intercept. That they have intercepted certain biological lines, and those they do not need to pay too much attention to, they would not bother with. But the only ones I think they would bother with are the ones that they can't actually do anything with. So it's a compliment to abductees, in my terms, for instance, that they are really something exceptional and resistant naturally to these greys. And on the subject of interception, I would say this. Interception is not the same as abduction. They're two different things. Interception is done by mental vectors, perhaps science-based on magnetic expression of some kind. Thought has a magnetic component to it. And not to get too technical about it, let me say that it is possible that this can be done. And in some kind of way, I think lots of military establishments around the world have tried to do this to stop armies fighting, for instance, or whatever, by some kind of mental expression or whatever. And I would say that if you really want the masters of this, it may well be this technology that's come here through space-time past the speed of light. I think they've got the fine art on this, really. And to resist this interception, I would say the best thing is to try to be as different to them as possible. As possible to be, as different to a machine psychology that can only know the physical universe as it is possible to look at. Make your priorities based on values that kind of, you know, treasure that which is not purely physical and atomic. In other words, do the things that most human beings have a capacity to try to do, to look after someone else's welfare and so forth. And it's not being this kind of, you know, mushy, goody-goody stuff. I think it's in our interest, really in our interest, to look to someone outside you. If you help 10 other people in a room, and you stop helping.
Nigel, I need to ask, I understand your philosophy and your story in this, but why would that stop the Greys from working on us because we're good people and we're doing the right thing? Wouldn't that intrigue them more?
Their psychology doesn't tune into that, you see. You're resisting something that they do not understand. They have no capacity to understand that kind of thought form. In fact, lots of abductees actually explain how these babies are actually taken out of women that they have experimented on, and they're given to the woman, and these gray aliens watch the way even a hybrid baby is looked at by a human mother with a sense of maternal love or expression of caring. They do not understand that sense of the outward, which is what an emotion really is, something that goes out from someone. And I think that within that frame of reference, they're trying to understand, a very good question you ask, they're trying to understand what makes us different from them so that they can program that difference into their psychology in order to fit in with ours, in order to get this propensity to maybe live and beat the second law of thermodynamics, which is something that they are subject to because they're physical and they're atomic. The second law will take out anything made of force, like or atoms or whatever. And I think that what we are is we have a propensity to live outside the paradigm of force in another paradigm altogether, one that brings things together that's not of force. And I think that's what they're here for. That is so attractive to them because their high intelligence would tell them there is something here that is not programmed into them that they can see operating for a so-called primitive species, but they keep going into this paradigm that's not a force and coming back and so forth and so on. And I think they sense there is another universe of all things together that might be called the Godverse, and maybe that that is why they're here, for this one incredible thing. Invariably, they can never reach this other universe, though. This is the point. They themselves can never do that, and yet they can seek it because they can see it with their artificial intelligence in terms of our behavior and the kinds of outlays that we bring about. And in the end, that's why we will win, I believe. And we will win because we can stay in that place that they can never go to, really, basically. And I think that's the only way we can defeat a technology of their immensity, is to stay in that place that they can never tread, basically. And please, I hope I don't sound like some creature. Because I certainly am not that. I have to say this, but, you know, in looking at all these various criterions and so on, David, it's one looks at, and one hitches the whole thing together. One thinks, how on earth can you keep this to yourself? So anyway, I had a go, wrote the books, and I put it out there, and let's hope that it's really for the young ones. It's for the little ones. Our lives, at least mine, have run its full, fairly good course in it, and so let's hope that my children have something to say about this, and this is all over.
I appreciate it. Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for joining us over these last two nights and sharing
pleasure.
Your ideas and thoughts.
Pleasure, yeah.
And, you know, certainly I'd love to have you back and talk more about this in the future. And when the third book comes out, please, Nigel, let us know. And we'd love to talk to you about the future information that you're getting ready to share.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the privilege of talking to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank
and,
you very much.
Gentlemen, please be safe. And thank you very much for sharing with us. I want to. It's been an intriguing couple of nights. Certainly, a lot to think about. As our guests have deluged us with quite a bit of information. Where do you stand, Mel? Do you think that a lot of it I follow. I don't know that I follow that the aliens can't handle us being good to one another, and that they can't wrap their mind around that.
I'm kind of there with you.
You know that they're not able to discern that. I mean, I guess if we're in an energy field, and if we truly are a form of energy, as you know, science believes, if they're unable to track that portion of us, you know, my fear would be then, do they get frustrated and start just offing us because they can't understand, you know, or are we just using humanity on them then to kill or destroy what we can't control? You know, if they seem to traverse this far to come study us
right.
and work on us, I don't understand the engineering prospect of. And I would have asked more questions about that, but we have 2 minutes left, and each question begat a 12-minute answer. I there would have been no time to fit this in for this evening, and perhaps we can have them back in the future to discuss this more. But yeah, if they're genetically engineering or tweaking us to see how we work and why we work, it just seems like it would be more of a frustration for aliens if we're doing things that they can't understand and there's no way for them to map.
Yeah, I have a feeling I'm going to be staying up late tonight thinking.
Well, that's a good start. It's a good start, Mel.
To think?
Yes.
But you know what? Now I've just been inundated with all of this information. I'm just going to be sitting there trying to make sense of it all and just like, oh my gosh. I don't know. It's just weird.
Well, it's, you know, and it's interesting that they're able to go through different venues for the information they came from.
Yeah.
I don't know that I followed everything, and I don't want to put that on them. we had a very short amount of time over these two nights, and they seemed to have – I probably could have had them on each night this week for an hour.
Right.
And I think we still would not have gotten through all the amount of information that
they had. Well, the Shroud of Turin with it – with the body burning brighter than the sun for
– For a moment. Well, that's been a question, right, that there might have been that radioactive flash as Christ changed from human form into his energetic form, which caused that negative that it created on the Shroud of Turin. So I've heard that – talked about before. I don't know. It's definitely interesting, and
yeah.
I'd love to have them back on. But go check out nigelkerner.com, nigelkerner.com for more information and to order the books. They're certainly worth a read.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm betting in a linear fashion, they're a lot easier to follow than the interview.